Morning.
Morning.
Doesn't the air feel great? Just stop for a second and feel it on your skin. I opened the door this morning and I said, it's like the outside is air conditioned. That's really sick. I want to can you hear me back there? Sorry, I get kind of quiet. I want to give an appreciation this morning of the life of Joko Beck, who died in June at age 94. She was one of the first generation of American Zen teachers. How many of you know who Joko Beck was? Very much about Joko Beck? Okay, so some. So I heard that she was in hospice care a couple of weeks before she died, and so I pulled out my books and of hers and read them again and found I have a biography of Buddhist women teachers in America called Meetings with Remarkable Women, which is a wonderful book. And there was an interview and an article about her in there. So I reread that. The library has a set of CDs of hers that I had never heard. So I want to talk about what I learned about her life and my impressions of her her teaching and her approach to Zen. It's a little tricky when you've never met somebody or practiced with them, but I'm going to give it my best shot. So she died on June 15th, and I was struck by there a number of that first generation of American Zen teachers has died. It feels like recently. Robert Aiken died a year ago Friday, so I thought about him too. And Darlene Cohen died in January, and I thought that Daido Roshi had died recently, but it turns out it's 2 years in October that he died. But it feels like, somebody pointed out to me, this is what happens, you know. You have a first generation of anything and they die, which hadn't occurred to me. So anyway, I want to talk about her life, but also three aspects of her teaching. One is about ordinariness, and one is about reimagining Zen practice for Americans. And then the last one is one of the more notable, unique takes that she had on Buddhist practice. So I'm going to start out with ordinariness. I've been in large groups of Buddhist practitioners and teachers, and sometimes you'll be in this really large group of people, and then another person will walk in the door, and it's like the air changes. You know, something really changes. You know that? I mean, this isn't just with Buddhist teachers, obviously. It's with everybody. But I've really noticed it with Buddhist teachers. Somebody walks in the door, and you just, who is that? You know, there's this kind of a little electricity that happens somehow. And sometimes I think it's conscious on their part or developed, and sometimes I think it just happens. And then there's people who you would never pick out of a crowd. And I'm fascinated by those standout people. I'm just fascinated by them. You know, I'm like, who are you? What is the deal? So I'm fascinated by them, but I'm really drawn to the ordinary ones. I'm really drawn to the ordinary ones. So from everything that I've read and heard, she fell into that second category. So that's one aspect that I really appreciate about her. The school of Zen that she founded, which is it's called the Ordinary Mind School. And ordinary mind in that context means who we really are, who our natural person is. You know, we don't see it because of all our habits and our reactions and our, you know, the ways that we've developed of being. And we don't want to be ordinary. Nobody wants to be ordinary. So we need to do this practice to sort of re-uncover, is that a word? That ordinary mind. You could say that ordinary mind is the way, with a capital W. It's the way. So that ordinariness is one aspect of her practice that I like a lot. And another thing is that she did reimagine Zen practice for Americans. She didn't teach much from ancient texts. I read one time that instead of saying chop wood, carry water, she would say drive the freeways, shop for groceries. So she's very practice in everyday life oriented. And she simplified a lot of the forms and rituals that she had learned. And so the practice at her Zen center looked a lot more American, more Western, without sacrificing that traditional vigor that she had been trained in at Zen Center Los Angeles. I developed a new appreciation for this just recently. The idea of a simplicity of practice, because a couple of weeks ago I joined the YWCA, and I had been meaning to do it for years, and I'd never joined a gym in my life, you know, but I always had this idea that I was going to do it. So I took a tour, you know, and I didn't go back for about 5 months, and then I went back, you know, and I signed up. And I asked all these questions, you know, before I got there. I had these questions like, who are those people who go there, you know? What are they like? Where do they get the discipline to do that? And doesn't this sound familiar? Does this remind you of anywhere? You know, do I have to wear something special when I go there? Turns out, yes, I didn't own a pair of shorts, but now I do. You know, and what are the rituals here? You know, I got this tour, and they took me through a room full of exercise machines, and there was this very, it seemed to me, complicated sign-up procedure. Now, for these machines over here, you sign up on this sheet, and for those machines over there, it's on that sheet. And I said, well, what about those over there? Oh, you don't have to sign up for those. And my mind, you know, is just sort of breaking at this point. There's another room of exercise machines in the basement that you don't have to sign up for, but they're unbelievably complicated to use, but there's people behind the desk who can help you, but I'm not the kind of person who's, I'm too shy to go ask somebody for that kind of help. So I'm thinking I'm going to look stupid, you know, do something dumb. And the first time I was there, I capped it off by, I could not get out of the parking ramp. I couldn't figure out how to get out of the parking ramp. I got there, I put in my little ticket, you know, pulled it back out, and nothing happened. And that's when I realized there was nowhere to put your money in. What do I do now? So I started backing up, but then I hit the thing, you know. So then I pulled back up and tried it again, and it still didn't work. So I sucked it up and pushed the button and said, I feel really stupid. But how do you get out of this parking lot? So everything about it was really foreign to me. And going back the second time was the very hardest, you know, because now I knew what I was in for. And it gave me a lot of sympathy for beginning Zen students and middle time Zen students, you know. This place doesn't seem very complicated to me, but I'm sure it would have, you know, if I had just joined it, like I just joined the Y. So I've developed deep compassion around the whole idea of simple practice. I'll talk more about that Americanization later. And also later I want to talk about her approach to teaching, which had a real psychological element to it. You know, as the Dharma has traveled from country to country and culture to culture, it's changed every time. You know, it's sort of bent a little bit. It's morphed with every culture that it's encountered. And one of the ways that people have remarked that it has morphed in the West is that it's taken on an aspect of Western psychology. That's one of the changes that seems to be happening here. And Joko was in the vanguard of that. So, but I want to tell you a little bit about her life. She's from New Jersey, and she had a real ordinary life. She got married, had four kids, got divorced, moved to California, and she was a teacher for a while. She was a secretary for a while. And then she spent a long time working as an assistant in the chemistry department at the University of California, San Diego. And she began Zen practice when she was around 40, which I find very inspirational because that's about how old I was. And last week when Tonin was here, a lot of you met Tonin, she was about that age when she started too. So it gives me hope. Blanche Hartman of San Francisco Zen Center is another one. So she started Zen practice when she was about 40. She went to a talk at a Unitarian church with a friend of hers. She kind of wandered in with this friend, and it was a talk by Maizumi Roshi, and he greeted everyone at the door. So as each person walked in, he gave them a little bow, and he looked right at them, and it was this kind of direct contact. And they went and sat down, and her friend said, "What was that?" You know, and they were just sort of stunned by how completely there he was with them. And she said, you know, he wasn't doing anything special, except for once in her life she felt like someone was paying complete attention to her in that moment. So she said, "I wanted whatever he had." And you hear, I've heard people say this about Suzuki and Katagiri and a lot of different teachers. "I want what they had." And you know, at this time she was working in the chemistry department at UCSD, and she said that she was, at that time, she was surrounded by some of the most brilliant minds on the West Coast, but she said none of them were imperturbable, and she felt that this man was, so she was intrigued by him. So she started driving up to Los Angeles, to Zen Center of Los Angeles. She would drive the 2 hours each way up there every weekend to sit with Maizumi and his group and have Doksan to meet with him. And once a month, every month, she'd drive the 2 hours up there and back and go to Sesshin, go to retreat with them. So she was really dedicated, and she had a lot of determination, I think. And when she retired in 1977, she moved up there and lived at Zen Center Los Angeles. And she was ordained by Maizumi, and so for a number of years there, she lived there, she shaved her head, she wore robes, she did, you know, the entire sort of traditional practice. And Maizumi was unusual in that he had received transmission in two different lineages of Zen, both Rinzai and Soto. And so an unusual thing. So his students trained both with koans, and they also did Soto practice. And so she had that kind of rigorous koan training too. She received Dharma transmission from Maizumi, and she was one of 12 people that he gave Dharma transmission to. And a number of them became prominent Zen teachers in this country. Jan Chosen Bays was her Dharma sister. She's the abbot of Great Vow Zen Monastery in Oregon. Bernie Glassman, founder of the Zen Peacemakers Order, was one of the Dharma brothers and sisters. Dido Laurie from Mount Tremper, New York. What is it? Zen Mountain Monastery was in that group. And Dennis Genpo Mirzel was also in that group. So there must have been something going on there at that time. So she left Zen Center Los Angeles in 1983 and moved back down to San Diego and opened her Zen Center down there. And she was the head teacher there for 23 years until she retired in 2006. So she was there for a long time. She's the author of two books. She's the author of Everyday Zen, that's this one, and Nothing Special. And I went to find my copies of her book because I knew I had both of them, but it turned out I had two copies of this and none of the other one. So I had to go to the library. If anybody wants a copy of it, I've got an extra. And then, like I said, there were also these audio copies. There were also some audios made of her books. It was interesting to hear her voice because, you know, she sounded like anybody's aunt. She didn't sound, you know, she didn't have that kind of, and now I'm going to instruct you in Zen kind of way about her that we try so hard to avoid. So anyway, that was her life. So this American style of practice that she developed at San Diego started with, or it was exemplified by, the place that they were in. It didn't look anything like a temple. It was a regular little house in a suburb of San Diego on a regular, ordinary little suburban street, and there was sort of nothing Zen-like about it. Wanda Isle lived in San Diego for a number of years, and she told me that she couldn't believe it when she found out later that Joko Beck's place had been right on her walking path. She said, I'll bet I walked by it several times a week and never knew it was there. And she was bummed about that. But I don't know if there wasn't a sign or what. But, you know, I lived over here, right over here in the neighborhood in the late 70s and early 80s. And I'll bet I walked by this place, I can't tell you how many times. And just to show you the level of my mindfulness, I had no idea. Was there a sign out front back then, Nancy? Oh, there was. That makes it worse. A little sign. Oh, thank you. All you need is a sign. So, I want to read you a couple of things that she said about their style of practice. She said, we keep a simple framework of practice. We juggled space, and it isn't ideal, but that's part of why this place is interesting. Nothing has ever been quite right, but we learn to make do and make that our practice. A little chaos is often useful. So that turned my head around about some of the challenges that we have here. I mean, we have this beautiful space, and it's wonderful. And sometimes we have to juggle things around, you know. We have to learn how to make do with things. We have to figure out what to do with, you know, a tree that has to come down. And it seems like there's always something. But I really appreciated the idea of making that our practice. Although I have to say, a little chaos in my mind goes a long way. It may be useful, but it goes a long way. Another time she said, it's fine for Zen to be Americanized, but that doesn't just mean it must look American. It means to practice in a way that's best in this culture. I have nothing against Japanese-type services. They're very beautiful. It's just not where my energy goes. And on the other hand, she said that Zen in the West must, you know, has to change. But she said it mustn't be too fast. Some of these traditional forms are not just meaningless forms. They've developed for good reasons. The formality of the Zendo, for instance, the severity of it, performs a certain function. If you are too casual, the Zendo tends to lose rigor. You can't assume that all traditions are bad just because they look strange. So she had this reputation for being very non-traditional. And, you know, her personal style was informal. And the way that her Zen center was set up was what we would call very contemporary practice. And yet, she really valued that formality and her rigorous formal training. And from everything I've read and heard about her, it was very vigorous, very strong practice there. So, So she once she was in San Diego, she evolved her own way of teaching. You know, she said that she was open to using whatever was available that would transform people's lives. And I kept running into that word over and over again as I read her books and read interviews with her. She was always talking about transformation. That's what she was interested in. So her approach to teaching was that she taught students to work with the everyday emotions of life. Work with them instead of trying to avoid them or escape them. And that's something that, you know, that we hear about now, and, you know, doesn't seem so unusual now, but at the time, it was very unusual, I guess. She was interested in psychology for a long time, and she developed a way to integrate that into her teaching as part of the sitting practice. So, for example, you know the statement from Dogen, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self is to be enlightened by all things, or by the 10,000 things. And to Joko, as I understand it, to study the self meant to study or to be with or to be one with your thoughts, your reactions, you know, your emotional buttons, your habitual responses. But there's a dualism in watching your thoughts, watching your emotions. You know, it's these are my thoughts, these are my emotions, and sort of me and my thoughts, me and my emotions. So to study the self is to forget the self means to take that duality of me and my thoughts, me and my emotions, and to just be there with the emotions, to drop the storyline, to actually just be the emotion. Kind of make it into a gerund, you know. Being sadness, being sitting. Thich Nhat Hanh would say being peace, so that there isn't that duality there. So that's the studying the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self is to be enlightened by all things. She was not real interested, to say the least, in enlightenment experiences, you know, in this kind of breakthrough Satori enlightenment moments that people have. To her, you know, despite her Rinzai training, those were not the point of practice, or maybe beside the point of practice. She got to know, you know, a lot of people, and she said that she got to know a lot of people who had had all kinds of very powerful experiences, but their lives were still kind of messed up, and they were still kind of unsettled, and they weren't living according to their deepest intentions. And, you know, they didn't have that imperturbable mind at all. So when students came to her, you know, when they'd come to her in Doksan in private meetings, and they would say, I just had this amazing, you know, experience, and I have to tell you about it. I just had this unbelievable opening during Zazen. And she would say, okay, you got 2 minutes. And she would listen to them for a couple of minutes and hear all about it. And then she'd say something like, okay, that's fine. Now, how are you getting along with your family? Or how's it going at work? Or something like that. She really didn't want them holding on to those experiences or feeling like they were the important thing. Like they were the important thing. Her idea was helping them wake up right in the middle of life's messiness and life's unpredictability, right in the middle of all our messy stuff. So in doing that, she got to know a lot about her students and a lot about their lives, and she would point their Zen practice back to their lives. You know, so she knew if somebody was working on defensiveness or, you know, anger in their family or whatever it was, and when they would come in to see her, she would point their practice back to that all the time. Let me see. Here's another quote from her. She said, "What primarily concerns me is the necessity for a student to learn to be as awake as possible in each moment. The usefulness of these openings exists only if they clarify life and our ability to live it and serve it. Only when the mind and body are mostly free of reactivity can a true understanding of what life is become possible. Not through a momentary breakthrough, but through an open and compassionate living of life." So she was very much into how is your practice manifested once you get up off the cushion? You know, can we wholeheartedly enter each Dharma gate, each moment of our lives, when we're off the cushion? Can we be equanimous in our lives? Is it showing up? Is our practice showing up in our lives? She said something once about having her students watch their thoughts and watch their emotions, and she said after about 3 or 4 years of that, they would have a really good idea of how their minds and hearts worked. One of her students, I thought, put it pretty well in a nutshell. He said, "Joko Beck's contribution was to make our emotional life, our emotional reactions, tensions, and feelings, not obstacles to practice, but the focus of practice. Pain, anger, hurt, bodily tension were all perfect manifestations of the moment." Boy, that's something we don't want to hear. "To be experienced fully in and for themselves, not as something to be gotten through on the way to peace and calm and clarity." Not as something to be gotten through on the way to peace and calm and clarity. They are our life, and Zazen is a way to experience it rather than try to escape it. So I would add to that, you know, pain, anger, hurt, bodily tension, joy, love, happiness, ecstasy. You know, let's put those in. That's my editorial addition to that. So she taught her students to label their thoughts and to experience their bodies in a real felt kind of way. So if you would find yourself thinking, she would have you repeat your thoughts. It wasn't in a Vipassana way of noting your thoughts, but she would actually have them repeat their thoughts back. And having a thought that, boy, that fight with my brother last night was bad. Having a thought that, oh, my brother is such a jerk, you know. Having a thought that, well, I'm not such a, you know, whatever. Just repeating those thoughts back. And seeing the thought as a thought. And then when the emotion comes up, as I guess it, she felt that it always would, some emotion would come up, then you feel that, you feel your body tighten. And at that point, you drop the thought, you drop the storyline, and just feel that emotion in your body. So you might feel anger, you know, in a tightening of your shoulders, or you might feel anxiety as a fluttering in your chest, or you might feel defensiveness as kind of a pulling away or something. So she'd have them not try to suppress it, but just be with it, kind of not lean away from it and not lean into it, but just be there with it. And she felt that over time, the emotions would transform themselves and that people would become less hooked by them, as Pema Chodron would say, you know, less caught by every fleeting thought and emotion that went through their mind and their body. And then eventually you'd become less reactive in your everyday life when things come up. You know, you would notice it a lot quicker. You would notice things a lot quicker, and you'd be able to see them for what they are and then let them go. So that was her style of teaching. So she also talked throughout her writings about how this was difficult, persistent, daily work. She talked a lot about it being difficult work and work that you really had to persist in. So I think she when she would say things, it would remind me a little bit of my German grandmas. You know, you have to put the work in to get whatever it is out of it that you want out of it. So having had two German grandmas, I appreciated that attitude. And in her own life, she took up the practice of not ever letting a cranky thought sort of go through her mind without her noting it. She would talk about if she was in the middle of a conversation with somebody and a cranky thought came up, she wouldn't, you know, quit paying attention to the conversation and go, oh, what's the deal with that cranky thought? Does that come from my childhood? But she would just note it. Oh, that's interesting. And notice that she was doing it, see that it was there, and not judge it as good or bad, but notice it. And she felt that it was an important thing to always notice those emotions as they arose and not just sort of glide past them because you're in the middle of something more important. So she had this really interesting and unique kind of pioneering way, I think, of teaching the Dharma, especially in those early days when she was getting started. It wasn't without controversy, but she was also very, very widely admired in the Zen world, in the Buddhist world. So when I heard that she was in hospice, and she was only in hospice, I think, for a couple of weeks, and then she died. When I heard that, just inside, my heart just did a little, you know, gassho choko to her. So I think that's what I want to say about Joko. Oh, I have this. I had a number of quotes from her that I had for the bulletin, and I had, I think, three or four of them that I loved so much. I sent them all to Kimberly and said, "You pick one because I can't." And she had a hard time too, but this was the one that we put in the front of the bulletin. An interviewer asked her, "How has meditative awareness changed your life?" And she said, "It has changed my life in the direction of it being more harmonious, more satisfactory, more joyful, and more useful, probably. Though I don't think much in those terms. I don't wake up in the morning thinking I'm going to be useful. I really think about what I'm going to have for breakfast." So yay, Joko. Yay, Joko. So, oh, I can't stand it. I have to read you one other one. She was being interviewed by somebody who said, "Oh, I read your books." And she said, "Oh, you read." "Well, give up reading, okay?" And the woman said something like, "Well, your books are so wonderful." And she said, "Well, that's all right. They're all right. Read them once and that's enough. Books are useful, but some people read for 50 years, you know, and they haven't begun their practice." So, I like that a lot. Reading is all well and good, but, you know, you can read about ice skating or you can go ice skating. And if you're going to read about it, you know, please do the other one. If you're going to think about going to the Y for 20 years. So, anyone who wants to can ask me in November if I'm still going to the Y. So, Anybody have anything they want to say? Yes, Jim.
I saw her. She lectured here, I don't know how many years ago.
Oh, did she?
And at the first meeting in Linden Hills at the Unitarian Church, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But true to that form, she was lecturing, and a friend of mine was in the audience. We were all sitting there, hundreds of people. And she raises her hand and asks a question, and it's multifaceted, and it's beautiful, and it's flowery. And it's a home run cut for Joe Quebec to go off on what she had just said.
Uh-huh.
And she looks at him and she says, no. And then she turns. And for weeks after that, whenever I would meet my friend, I'd say, no. To whatever she'd say, but it was really one of the just pretty from what I saw. Close.
Yowza, huh? I met somebody recently who had been to her Zen Center years ago in San Diego, and the thing that she remembered most about it was that she said Joko had that sense of being completely there, like she talked about with Maizumi Roshi. She said she was one of those people who was just completely there, and she had that also that kind of air about her. Let's get down to business. Let's do it. So. Yeah.
You said that she was really interested in Americanization. What is the, have you heard stories or seen pictures? What is the San Diego Zen Center like? As far as, like, does she have any elements of Japanese, or is it totally uniquely American?
You know, I read so many different things from sort of different eras of it that I'm not sure I could really say. But what I do have in this book, which I can pass around, there's a picture of her standing out front of it, and it doesn't actually show her Zen Center, but it shows her and the neighborhood, and it looks, I swear to God, she's one of my aunts. So, but she told a story one time about how, you know, when I said that she was open to doing anything as long as it worked, right? She said that one time she went to a retreat in New York City, and they didn't have any cooking facilities there. And so what they would do for meals is everybody would go out to lunch at restaurants. And she thought, you know, how is this going to work? You know, people are going to totally lose their focused minds if they go out to New York City to a restaurant. And she said, but it absolutely worked. People would go and they would, you know, just have their meal and then they would come back. And so she had, I don't know if she did this all the time, but at least once she did a retreat where they would do walking meditation. To do walking meditation, they would get in their car and drive the, I don't know what, half an hour or something to the beach, and then do their walking meditation on the beach, and then get back in the car and drive back to her place. And she said it worked great. So, yay for innovation. So, yeah.
My friend and teacher, Therese, is always trying to remind me, just totally on that line of drive to lunch, like drive to the beach, with the analogy of chocolate. Very modern.
Yeah.
God, I was. She says, "Mike, your greatest barometer will be your reaction to traffic."
Ooh. It's so true. It's so true. There's traffic practice, and for years I have taken up the practice of waiting in line at the grocery store, and I'll tell you what, it's been transformative. It has been transformative.
You know that's why the Dalai Lama is so serene
because
he doesn't
drive. Yeah. Or probably wait in line at the grocery store either. Yeah. Yeah. This last week, Dave and I were in Mount Pleasant, Iowa, waiting for the Amtrak train. And the Amtrak trains are all messed up because of the bridges being out over the Missouri River. So we waited for 6 hours for the Amtrak train in this little town. It had a little railroad station that didn't have air conditioning, and it was one of those like 95 degree days. And you know, there was a nice little breeze. It was just fine. And when we got on the train, I was so grateful for the air conditioning, and everybody on the train is complaining like crazy, you know. But it made me so grateful for all those years of grocery store practice. I mean, you know, I'm with her totally on the transformative, you know. If this doesn't affect your life when you get off the cushion, you need to sit for another, I don't know how long, with a teacher and a sangha regularly. So, what else? Anybody? Yeah.
I have listened to a lot of her talks that I've downloaded, and mm-hmm. I have that every day is on CD, and I find her painfully honest. You know, more so than any other teacher I've listened to. But I remember this saying that said something like, a good Zen teacher doesn't tell you what you want to hear. They tell you what you don't want to hear.
What you need to hear.
That's her.
Yeah.
You said she founded a school of Zen for... I hadn't heard of it.
Well, it was that she that they call themselves the Ordinary Mind School of Zen. So her Dharma airs... you know, like Nonin has the Prairie Wind Order is what he calls his group. So I don't think it was a very formal thing. Yeah, I think it was just kind of what they called themselves. So or the what is it? Lord Mountain and Rivers Order is what he calls his. Sometimes they give themselves names, and or somebody else gives them names. I don't know. So yeah. Anything else? All right, let's have some tea, but first we'll have some announcements.